In the novel, two clerks inherit a fortune and leave their jobs to dabble in art and literature, eventually realizing that they have no talent for leisure. In the end, they return to their boring, steady, structured lives as clerks. The baby boomers would have to accept a similar fate. Under a new regime, they'd be required to work and support the millennial generation until a wholly new system was put in place. Jamal wandered, awestruck, through the rooms of his new home. His pit bull, Bouncer, loped a few steps ahead, sniffing behind a chair, pawing at a cabinet door, as if to flush out whatever animals might be hiding there. Each room opened into a larger room, the walls lined with pictures of white people, lined with fireplaces and shelves packed tight with books. Bright sunlight lit up big, clean windows in white paint. He'd requisitioned the house from a long list of surrendered properties. Photographs posted on the internet. Today marked the first time in his life he wasn't living under his mama's roof. The paintings looking down, they'd been a lineage of the old world. The stuck-up faces of high and mighty dead folks. The paintings could go. The books he'd keep. With Adjustment Day past, what Jamal truly wanted to do was write. To be an author who put a world of symbols and images into people's minds with his careful, steady stream of words. The way Talbot had done. As Talbot had phrased it, no man is an adult while his parents are alive. Until they die, he is merely a performance to either please or punish them. For too long, whites have acted as the finger-wagging parents of blacks. For even longer, heterosexuals have acted as the shaming parents of homosexuals. To Jamal, it seemed he'd always been expected to back down, to forever defer, step aside. He'd always played the submissive good guy because the only other role was to be a thug. Everything he'd done was meant to keep people happy. Killing people wasn't ideal, but it was the first time he wasn't trying to make them all love him. It mostly felt strange. Strange, not bad, because he wasn't trying to please these people. It felt nice to just shoot them and not worry about whether or not it made them happy. That relief made Jamal happy. Opposition seemed unlikely. The downtrodden had always turned to church, and their numbers had swelled until a leader appeared to organize their power. This time, history's displaced, the disenfranchised had long ago laughed off the idea of God. Their churches had been colleges and government offices, and these days their preachers were buried in mass graves. The new peasantry might have advanced degrees and awards galore, but they had no churches to harbor and comfort them. Smarter men might exist, stronger men, but Jamal was the one who pulled the trigger, so they would work for him. Whoever the owners of this house had been, they'd long since relocated to the appropriate homeland, traveled light from the look of it. They'd left behind their furniture, even the clothes and shoes in the closets. Not that it mattered. From today on, this would be his house, his land, his farm. Jamal's mother was installed in a house in town, nicer than anywhere she'd ever lived, but not near as nice as his place. Three floors from the look of it, with Greek temple columns out front. The only word that seemed fitting was grand, just as he'd always imagined it would be. He opened doors to find only more rooms, more doors and staircases. Behind one door, he found the kitchen. A woman his mama's age stood at the stove. She wore an old-time uniform, just a gray dress with a white apron tied over it. Her hair was netted tight to her head. "Pardon me," he said. This could be a mix-up. She was black, too. Could be the website had allocated the property to two parties by mistake. His status in a lineage gave him higher rank, of course. but he didn't relish the idea of putting somebody out of a house she'd come to think of as home. "I live on the place," she offered, the sound of boiling. "Me and my family look after things." Bouncer nosed his way past Jamal and moseyed over to press his muzzle alongside the woman's thick legs. When he didn't speak, she asked, "You the new owner?" She looked into the pan as she spoke. Like whatever she was cooking, she hated it to the point of sadness. He let out the breath he wasn't aware he'd been holding. Even the kitchen around her was a marvel. All knobs and drawers, hanging pots and copper sinks and machines, and all of it his. It would take him months, might be years, to grow into such a place. It relieved him, the thought he wouldn't be living here alone. Bouncer left the woman and went to sniff and paw at a door, a narrow door with a brass knob. The dog whined. He sniffed at the keyhole. The woman followed Jamal's eyes to the door. "It's locked," she said. "Been locked since we misplaced the key." The dog continued to sniff along the crack running beneath it. One paw scratched at the wooden floor. "Must be he smells mice," the woman said. She turned back to the pan she was minding on the stovetop. "Nothing up those stairs but the attic." Her voice was sing-song, featherweight, saying, "No, just one empty old attic." Jamal went and collared the dog, dragging Bouncer away from the locked door. "Where are my manners?" he said, and he offered her his free hand. "My name is Jamal Spicer." She did a double take, one eyebrow arched, looking him up and down slow, as if for the first time. Her shoulders sagged, and she shook her head as if to clear her vision. "You the one from the TV?" From the first lineage is what she meant. The state media had been running little biographies to introduce people to the system of men who'd be running the new nation of Blacktopia. Each man in his tribe had read aloud from the Talbot book, and these readings rotated night and day. Seeing himself on television had made Jamal feel sick with the limited reality of himself, his crooked teeth and big ears. But getting recognized had begun to make him proud to be the man he turned out. The woman wiped her hands in her apron and accepted his handshake. "Pleased to make your acquaintance," she said, her voice breathless with amazement. A smile relaxed her face, a glad smile, not like part of the uniform she was forced to wear. "My name's Arabella." Folks here to cook and clean for him. It would seem like he'd walked into a ready-made family. "Here's Bouncer," he said, shaking the dog by its collar, and Jamal returned her smile. The wait stood as his only option. Gavin had registered as a resident alien, gone to the post office and filled out the forms, declared his homosexuality, and taken an oath to the same. The clerk who'd administered the oath fixed him with a stern look. "You know you can't work," she'd warned. "Not legally." Gavin had read as much in the Talbot book. "You can't vote or operate a motor vehicle either," the clerk had said. Gavin said, "I understand." The clerk slipped a pamphlet from a packet of papers. She read, "Until relocation can be approved, resident aliens must report their current place of residence and any changes in said place to the appropriate authorities." That meant his parents' house. Fat chance he could move out, not without a job or a driver's license. The Declaration of Interdependence guaranteed mutual respect between all races and sexualities, but respect was easier when each was isolated, snug in his own homeland. Gavin was an outsider, stuck among heterosexuals. For how long, nobody could say. To make matters worse, the clock was ticking. To be queer, at least until Adjustment Day, meant almost 2 decades of torture. Being called Gavin and getting pounded into lockers on a weekly basis with parents who hadn't a clue about what a queer kid needed to know. But the payoff was turning 18. That birthday vaulted a person from being the weakest, most victimized member of society to the heights of becoming one of the most powerful. Women knew this transformation. One day, their off-limits, horsey, cultish jailbait, ignored, dismissed. And the next day, they're leading men around by the nose. Rich men, powerful men, the most attractive men in the world are vying for a young woman's attention. It was a form of power that didn't last forever, but it was power. And it could be leveraged for money and education and access to people. Eventually, to a more lasting form of power. Sure, someday he'd be a lawyer or an engineer, but for now, Gavin merely wanted to be beautiful and pull the focus every time he entered a room. After so long getting ridiculed and slammed into walls, he deserved his moment in the spotlight. The window of youth opened at 18, and it had a shelf life. Gavin loved his parents, but he couldn't wait to emigrate to a world where he'd be normal. Until then, he was more or less a hostage. The holdup came in the form of the compensation clause. The Talbot book held that homosexuals accrue wealth and skills faster because they're not burdened with bearing and raising their young. Like the egg of a cuckoo, the homosexual child was born into a heterosexual home and fledged to join his homosexual family. Thus, the heterosexual exhausted time and resources that ultimately benefited the homosexual world. A constant export of new adults from the white and black homelands to the homosexual represented a trade imbalance of the cruelest kind. Young, vital, fully schooled offspring were siphoned away to their appropriate homeland, while their parents were left without compensation or support in their waning years. It wasn't ideal. Gavin understood that. The compensation clause had been enacted to balance the situation. It stated that a homosexual adult raised by heterosexuals could immigrate only when a heterosexual raised by homosexuals was ready to immigrate. Somewhere, Gavin prayed, a kid was coming out as straight to his lesbian parents. That kid would, like Gavin, get sent to the post office where a clerk would give him the forms Gavin had just now filled out. That disapproving, cluck-clucking clerk would warn the straight kid not to seek employment or operate a vehicle or attempt to vote in any election. And that kid, the anti-Gavin, would go back to his 2 mommies or 2 daddies or whatever the case might be to pray for a phone call. Senior year, they'd done a unit on Adjustment Day and the new nation states. The teachers who were left, the ones who weren't buried in the end zone of Franklin High School's football field, those teachers were giddy with praise for the lineages. To listen to them, the lineage guys were heroes. If it wasn't for the heroes, Gavin's generation would have been marched off to die in the false flag war. Gavin included, thanks to stupid equal civil stupid rights. When his teachers hadn't been reading aloud from the Talbot book, they'd been lecturing that the men had been justified. Students held up camera phones and tried to catch anyone not carrying the blue-black book or not expressing love for the new order. The lineages were justified, as per the teachers, due to the fact that male babies used to have their genitals routinely mutilated, and the courts of law were biased against men in child custody and no-fault divorce cases, and because the prisons were so filled with men that the male suicide rate was more than 4 times the female suicide rate. Between lectures, they'd watched an educational film. Bulldozers pushing great moldering heaps of something. This mess wasn't the usual slaughter of tiny baby roosters. Screaming flocks of seagulls wheeled in the air, circling the bulldozers and the garbage being buried. A gull dove to grab something, then flew past the camera. Pinched in one of the bird's talons was an ear. The mounds of gray squash stuff being ground beneath the bulldozer treads and bladed into the dirt they were untold numbers of human ears. When called upon, students were expected to know each article of the Talmud book by heart. For example, bounty will be paid for information leading to the arrest of any person using any unit of currency other than the Talmud. As an alien resident, Gavin wasn't eligible to earn bounty money. In theory, Gavin should have been happy. Only nobody mentioned all the blood, and how people could find bullet holes in the cafeteria wall behind where the targets were lined up. No duh, homosexual homeland sounded great to Gavin, but he felt conflicted, as if he'd met a young priest wearing a short-sleeved shirt. Only the guy has sexy tattoos. Only he's a priest. Only his arms are astonishingly muscular. Only the tattoos are full of swastikas. That kind of a mixed blessing. Gavin hadn't been asked to wear a pink triangle, but that didn't seem very far down the road. Only there wasn't much choice. This was the new real world, so he was going home to sit and wait by the phone. Back in the before times, Walter's fingers had slowed, as if walking behind Talbot's voice. Walter's writing, the shadow of the old man's talk. He'd expounded on the idea of perishable money and how it would create a ferocious climate of earning and spending. Such money would be a medium instead of an asset. It would no longer keep human time and energy suspended in locked vaults. It had been slow going, whether from blood loss or age. The old man had rambled. The principle of fatal contrarians holds that society has worked against the benefit of certain individuals for so long that those persons will never trust it. They will continue to position themselves against society regardless of its aims, even if those goals ultimately work in the contrarian's best interests. Talbot had gasped awake. His head had lolled on his stringy neck, and the dried blood had crusted in his wrinkles, those furrows across his forehead, and the crow's feet radiating from the corners of each eye. Flakes of red littered his shoulders as he dictated, "People will celebrate beauty or genius, but not when they occur in the same person. To find both qualities in one individual occurs as an injustice no one will tolerate. When it happens, either one or both gifts must be destroyed." Walter had checked on the list every hour. Names had appeared and vanished, and those that remained were collecting impressive votes, the politicians especially. Talbot would nod off, his head flopped to one side, and Walter would toggle to the list website. With a snort, his new old man would jerk awake and announce, "Drugs are popular because they give the user a window of madness or illness that can be scheduled. Unlike sickness, drugs can synchronize the infection, derangement, and recuperation of a group of people." Pronouncement made, the old man had collapsed into another drooling stupor. As for the list's purpose, Walter had no idea. It consisted only of names and numbers. Names and numbers. As per Talbot's instructions, if someone posted a name and it didn't attract at least 3,000 votes within a week, Walter was to delete it. To guess by the pattern, the way the numbers seemed to double every day, then double the next, knowledge of the website was spreading by word of mouth. On an impulse, Walter had entered the name of his least favorite professor. The man had failed him for refusing to accept every lecture as gospel. Walter had typed the name Dr. Emmett Brawley and hit enter to post it. The list had automatically scrolled to show where the name occurred in the alphabetical order, sandwiched between a state senator and a cable news anchor. Even as he'd watched, a single vote appeared beside Brawley's name. A 2 replaced the 1. A 3 replaced the 2. No parents ever named their child Delicious Bastille. That's the name she chose for her immigration papers. A new homeland, a new name. Beginning on adjustment day, Every immigrant took advantage of a fresh start. Aristides and Aristotles, Baccarats and Beauregards, and Delicious, who without question should not have worn buttermilk yellow crepe muslin, not if she'd suspected it would rain, donning a skin-tight dress without a coat or wrap. No amount of elastic and underwire could improve upon the eye-popping curves of her body, so she did without. Halfway from where she'd parked, the skies had opened up, every drop painting the pale fabric to her until the dress hid no more of her mocha skin than would a layer of melted butter. Every lesbian eye snuck peeks at her, at the swelling breasts that seemed to lunge up, up and away from Delicious Bastille's chest, the nipples, two obvious purple bullseyes beneath her clinging bodice. Strangers eye-raped the taut muscles of her tawny thighs, the savory cleft of her ample buttocks, all so clearly delineated through her rain-soaked skirt. Let them stare, she told herself. Their stares had prevented her from looking around the restaurant. If she'd met their leering eyes, she'd never be able to hide her frustration and rage. Here she sat, naked for all intents and purposes, picking half-heartedly at her salad. She kept her eyes fixed on only immediate objects, her glass of Pinot Noir, her bread plate, the single pink rose in the table center. She shut out the buzzing dining room filled with gays and lesbians. Except here, they weren't gays and lesbians. In the complete absence of heterosexuals, the people seated at the tables around her amounted to mere men and women. Men and women. To help avoid so many eyes, she focused on her dinner companion. Across the table sat a woman sporting a wild blaze of red hair. The post-relocation name she went by was Ginger Prestige, and she was the latest of many blind dates arranged for Delicious by the women in the Aerospace Corporation. None of her co-workers seemed able to tolerate an unmarried woman in their ranks, so they were forever throwing Delicious together with single women named Calyx or Esteem. Delicious suspected that a single gal was a threat in the paired-up domesticated world of middle-aged women's society. The redhead lifted long fingers to toy with a dangling curl beside her face. She met Delicious's gaze and asked, "So, you're an aerospace engineer?" Delicious sipped from her glass of wine. She gave a modest nod. The woman, Ginger, looked sheepishly at Delicious's transparent dress, which stretched taut to cover her tiny waist. The admiration shined in her blue eyes as she said, "What you're doing is so heroic." What she referred to was the mission to Mars, a tentpole nationwide campaign to unite the fledgling homeland and claim, at least symbolically claim, the entire planet of Mars in the name of the Oscar Wilde set. Delicious was one of the homeland's leading experts in rocketry, arguably the linchpin of the nation's race to put same-sex-oriented astronauts on the red planet. Delicious had only taken a single sip of wine. To avoid temptation, she signaled for the waiter to take away her nearly full glass. Ginger's long fingers and full lips invited fantasy. Delicious shuddered with a frisson of sensation as she imagined Ginger's freckled pink face at work between her own cocoa thighs. The brilliant aerospace engineer caught herself and shook off the appealing vision. She'd been alone too long, trying to remain faithful. The fantasy said less about Ginger's sexiness than it did about how long Delicious had abstained from sex. Ginger waved for the waiter to refill her own glass, saying, "I'm drinking for two." Of Delicious, she asked, "What sign are you?" Delicious rearranged the napkin spread atop her little lap, saying, "Late May." Ginger smiled, "A Gemini." When Delicious failed to engage, the redhead asked, "So, as an aerospace guru, what do you think of the whole flying pyramid thing?" Delicious had been celibate for 5 months. 20 soul-crushing, lonely weeks had gone by since she'd entered this strange nation. She began fork-raping her salad greens in search of an artichoke heart, lifting her eyes to request a glass of orange juice. Another boring glass of orange juice, and what she craved was a vodka martini. A vodka martini with three garlic-stuffed olives and a certain blonde man's massive rock-hard erection, bringing her to a toe-curling climax. When she glanced up for a waiter, she saw the blonde man. He sat in a narrow booth at the far edge of the room. A thin white man, skinny, with at best a tennis player's build, but in actuality hardly more than skin and bone. She recognized his blonde hair, cut longer now, and combed in a boyish spray across his wide ivory forehead. He sat sideways to her so Delicious could see his full profile. Across from him ate a heavily muscled giant, a black man barely contained in a too-tight jersey pullover. The giant's jeans-clad legs were visible beneath the table, and Delicious watched as he wedged both meaty knees between the knees of the slender white man and slowly began forcing those bony knees apart. The slightly built man pulled away, but the confines of the booth didn't allow room for him to fully escape contact, and Delicious watched as the predatory giant spread the unwilling man's scrawny legs. Blushing, holding back tears of humiliation, the slender blonde seemed to sense Delicious watching and turned to meet her gaze. She looked away, her heart knocked against her ribs. Here, a woman risked everything if she stared a moment too long at a man. She could be fired from her job, evicted from her home. The government could take custody of her children, and she'd be deported to a homeland, white or black, where no one thought it a perversion for women and men to be intimate. If the redhead had noticed, she said nothing. She sipped her wine and ruminated about the baby-making race. Every hour, heterosexuals were creating homosexuals. The homosexuals could never keep pace. They'd never provide matching numbers of heterosexual children to exchange, and that meant a steady backlog of homosexual children trapped in heterosexual homelands. Her office with the government tracked the numbers, she explained. In an attempt to balance the books, they were proposing a cash equivalent be paid for children who couldn't be traded for children. A kind of dowry would be paid to the heterosexual parents as compensation for their efforts and to help fund their old age. Called a liberation fund, it amounted to hundreds of millions of dollars, but the monies could be raised through donations. Delicious only half listened. It took every strength she possessed to not turn and look at the blonde man. She sensed his eyes on her, on the soft curve of her breasts, and she gritted her teeth in her effort not to weep. As the palace of San Simeon is to the isolated stretch of California coastline, so is Maryhill Castle to the Pacific Northwest. Each is the steel-reinforced concrete legacy of a wealthy tycoon, sheathed in old-world architectural details and furnished with the treasures bought at fire sale prices from impoverished royal families. Both edifices stand atop heights, overlooking the dramatic landscape for miles. Each was nicknamed by its respective builder as the Ranch. All magnificence appears as folly at first. As the Eiffel Tower dared to rise above Paris in 1887, the French cultural maven Victor Hugo condemned it as a hideous oil derrick that would deface the city. Likewise, as the Empire State Building was completed in 1931 and sat through the Depression without tenants, the people of New York began to deride their new landmark as the Empty State Building. Time legitimizes the outrageous. Maryhill, that improbable Italian palazzo, is no less impressive than its California rival because of its grim situation. A desert surrounds it, little aside from barren, wind-scoured scablands. Ornate bronze grills wrought in some Renaissance style bar the windows, making it as much a prison as a fortress. For accumulated within are Slavic thrones and crowns, czarist portraits and priceless porcelain looted from the Orient. And it was in this ready-made kingdom that Charlie established his household. His income amounted to the only source of Talbot dollars in the region, so the destitute for miles around presented themselves at his door. Hat in hand, each asked to be taken into his patronage. The most comely among them, Charlie accepted his team wives, with the marginally more attractive made to serve in his household, while the lesser would labor as field wives. To a woman, they were all to wear rippable bodices, and the men were to wear kilts or trews as the weather did dictate. Charlie himself favored an over-tunic densely embroidered in gold, worn to cover a linen shirt featuring commodious sleeves. Velvet-paned trunk hose adorned his lower limbs, the fabric made fast about his calves and ankles by a criss-crossing of leather thongs. For such a costume was in keeping with the nascent cultural identity of Caucasia. Among the long list of arduous tasks was the renaming of everything, for every mountain and watercourse needed to be rechristened in accord with the emergent society. In addition, did Charlie order the erection of a stout stone brewhouse for the manufacture of mead, as he did summon the waters of the mighty Columbia River from henceforth to be referred to as the Charlie Bourne. He decreed that waters enough be piped and compelled upland, as to provide for the farming of expansive fields. A grand enterprise did Charlie undertake to found. His palace was quickly the center of expanses of curly endive giving way to great swaths of sugar beets, cilantro, and a surplus of rutabagas. In accord with the cultural values of Caucasia, did common men roam the countryside attired in tunics and cassocks and capes, shod in boots and sandals, dependent upon the season, while atop their heads sat headgear denoting their rank. Liveried were many in doublets featuring gored sleeves of flashing ruby-colored brocades. About their shoulders they carried the jewels plundered from no few museums and more, for pearls could be bought from the formerly well-off for the price of an egg, and gold had use to neither the starving nor the dead. So Charlie and his courtiers did squire and bind to themselves the youngest and the most lovely, whom could be flushed out. And by the wearing of such raiment did Charlie and his fellow chieftains of Caucasia rediscover their noble heritage. And trust in Venetian breeches did they grip pewter flasks of hearty ale and clang those tankards together with boisterous toasts to one another. Busy were the home wives all, those multitudinous teams of wives, sowing sporans. The challenge of proving himself a hero gave way to the business of managing domestic affairs, and Charlie was too busy to question whether or not he was ever satisfied. Yet even while he did gad about, attired in tabards and brigandines, quilted gambesons, jerkins, and houppelands, even then did an emptiness assail him. In response did Charlie appoint a committee for the revival of proper culture, which revived the minuet, revived gallantry and courtier hand-kissing, instituted the mandatory practice of white-speak, and furthermore, to suffuse his realm with meaning, did he reinstate the worship of Odin and Thor, and to that end did pioneer the building of an antique cathedral complete with flying buttresses and naves. But even as he knelt at the rail and partook of the newly invented ancient sacraments, even then did Charlie feel dissatisfied. Busy and fed were his subjects. They did consult neglected texts in search of recipes for dyes and patterns for the tatting of forgotten laces, and as tunics grew shorter, the boldest of their company donned cod pieces with gilded leather encrusted with pearls. And in the vicinity of these cod pieces were team wives always prepared to be interfered with. A swain might doff his Tudor cap or plume tricorn, but the chivalry more oft ended there. This aforementioned emptiness put Charlie in mind of high school. He hearkened back to English class and the study of Flaubert's unfinished novel, Bouvard and Pécuchet. While his more vibrant schoolmates cut capers and bandied about enticements to attain sexual ecstasy, boy Charlie had pored over the book, retaining its basic premise. Two clerks had bestowed a fortune and leave their normal lives in order to discover greater satisfaction in a more ennobling passion. The two tear through wine, art, horse racing, and find none sufficiently fulfilling. In the end, they return to their former lives of number crunching and scribbling in ledgers. That parable now stuck in Charlie's craw, as if he were swallowing a peanut butter sandwich eaten too fast in two big bites. Was it possible that he was incapable of savoring life as a potentate? Had he risen too far above his natural station as a lowly grease monkey of the shop floor? He'd heard tales of nascent rock musicians, avant-garde figures cast from the same mold as Kurt Cobain, who once they were rewarded with a fortune, bought the requisite manor house simply because it seemed the next rite of passage. Only, for years after, they'd occupy a single room of the same, often the smallest room, often only a large closet. Considering that precedent, Charlie resolved not to shrink from his destiny, but to gradually expand into his new role. And while the womenfolk of his household were compliant and privileged to bear his progeny, he needed one who could help shoulder the burden of his reign. It dawned upon him that his next challenge, perhaps his greatest challenge, would be to balance the inequity between the men and women of his lands. To that end, would he track down and master an exceptional female for the purpose of grooming her to serve as a suitable public wife? Whereas the women did all the stooped labor in the fields and women kept tidy the chambers of his Marahel palace, while menfolk did quaff lager and swagger about sowing seeds of the next generation. If Charlie were to grant wealth and power to a single female, raising her to the status of deity, that act would counterbalance the low position of all her female underlings. The enzymes in Piper's cells began their self-destruct process of autolysis, digesting the cellular walls and releasing the liquefied mess within. Bacteria present in his lungs, his mouth, sinuses, and digestive tract gorged themselves on this amber flood of amino acids. Flies found the eyes, the rectum, genitals, and nostrils and began to lay their eggs. Larvae hatched and burrowed beneath the skin to devour the layer of subcutaneous fat. The eyes collapsed. The intestines had already collapsed, effectively sealing themselves and trapping the gas produced by the bacteria in the digestive tract, and the belly began to bloat. Trapped bacteria swelled the face and genitals, swelling the tongue until it extended between the stretched and swollen lips. The penis expanded in a final mock erection, turgid with the byproducts of bacteria. The only sound was the noise of maggots devouring the face. A crackling sound, the exact same noise as studded snow tires make, driving slowly over bare pavement. The abdominal wall ruptured, the gas vented, and the torso collapsed into a foul-spreading puddle. The bacteria in the mouth digested the palate and attacked the brain, which dissolved quickly, escaping from the ears. Meat-eating beetles, Anthrenus verbasi and Dermestes lardarius, arrived to feast on the muscles. Then possibly only the skin and bones remained. Most likely the beetles resorted to eating the skin. All the while the television remained on, the same man being devoured by beetles, devoured by maggots. He looked out upon his mortal remains and said, "The coward takes offense on behalf of others. Let each man take responsibility for his own reaction." The maggots matured into flies and laid more eggs, and the handsome man on the television screen told the flies crawling over his skeleton, "To make a career of rescuing people is also to create a permanent class in need of rescue." Flies lined the windows of the condominium. Dead flies covered the windowsills, and still more flies laid their eggs. Maggots and more maggots hatched. And the man in his bespoke Savile Row suit told them, "We must allow each individual to persevere or to perish as he chooses." Each new generation of flies laid its eggs and matured and died trying to reach the sunshine outside the closed windows until the subcutaneous fat was consumed, and the last among the last generation of flies fell dead on the windowsill. Even then, the man on the television, whose face might be that of a king or saint or president, he looked over the skull and bones on the floor beneath him and told it, "A man is not going to get loved by being lovable." For immigration, she'd chosen his name, Gentry Tate. He'd chosen Delicious Bastille for her. They toasted their new monikers with champagne, but not much, because she desperately wanted to get pregnant. Hiding it kept them together, but any day the knock could come to their door. He'd be deported, relocated to the ethnic state for whites. She'd be held there, in the former state of Louisiana, renamed part of Blacktopia. If she bore a child, it would be tested and assigned an appropriate homeland. They'd first planned to escape to Canada, but a million interracial couples had hatched the same idea. To stem the rush, Ottawa had closed the borders, leaving them with one option if they wanted to remain together. Not together together, not as man and wife, not even as friends or acquaintances who met occasionally in passing. No, passing as homosexuals was their only option. The queer nation admitted both blacks and whites, and no genetic testing could betray their actual sexualities. Not that the homosexuals didn't foresee these attempts. Rumor had it that desperate mixed-race families were splitting apart temporarily and immigrating, then surreptitiously reuniting. Mexico had long ago stopped accepting refugees. Delicious had dated a woman who worked in the Fraud Detection Division of Immigration Policy. The woman had made it clear that immigrants caught engaging in covert heterosexual activities would be imprisoned. Due to the high number of homosexual youths in Caucasia waiting for exit visas, the queer nation was aggressively searching for closeted heterosexuals in order to trade them for the would-be gay immigrants. If found out, Delicious would be relocated post-haste. Gentry, too, but each to a different ethnic state. It did present a conundrum. They joked about seeking each other out late at night in grimy unisex public toilets, kisses stolen in filthy back alleys. Demeaning and degrading as those circumstances loomed, at the very least, Delicious and Gentry would preserve their attachment to each other, their love, and their future child. Until the child was the age to declare his or her sexuality, until then, they could be a little family. They might even share custody, handing off the child in gritty, grimy adult bookstores when they met for trysts in some unspeakably wretched, sticky-floored pornography arcades where their fellow secretive homosexuals went to consummate their frowned-upon passions. Sordid conjugal visits in pits of sleaze. Considering such a tableau, Delicious couldn't help but think of the Holy Savior born in a dirty stable. That had turned out well, more or less. She despised the thought of her child being used as a pawn in international politics, but that decision was 18 years in the future. It was possible that by then, laws would change. If the child chose to be gay, it might even serve as an anchor baby to keep her and Gentry in the same homeland. One blessing about orange juice is that it gave her a constant excuse to tinkle. She dabbed at the corners of her mouth with her napkin and fixed her date with a meek smile. Nature calls. She rose from her chair, deliberately not glancing in the direction of Gentry and his aggressive he-man. Dare she think, date? Between the open stares regarding her transparent yellow dress and her deliberately slow promenade across the dining room, elaborately circumnavigating it, wending her way between tables as if confused about the location of the toilets, with both those factors to her advantage, she could only hope her husband would notice her and hurry to catch up. Shasta found the website. The banner read, Bride of Kings, and below that it listed each member of each lineage currently reviewing prospective brides. One named Brock, a former forklift operator who'd taken possession of an island estate near Seattle where he lived with his harem of team wives. The site listed him as seeking additional matches. Brock owned a growing chain of diners. Shasta had seen the revolving signs that towered above freeway exits. In bold black letters against a lighted background, the signs read, "Whites Only." Whether this was a boast or an ironic expression of resignation, Shasta couldn't begin to guess. The menu offered Nazi penne pasta, a Klan burger, a Hitler veggie taco salad. Brock and his ilk, princes and barons they called themselves, last month's grease monkeys and dog groomers, an aristocracy of former steam fitters and garbage haulers. They'd picked up guns and blown the brains out of civilization. They'd read the Talbot book. They lived by it. By reading it herself, she could guess how her life as a team wife would turn out. As a broodmare, popping out white babies to repopulate the new nation-state. A string of babies born a year or less apart. What her own mom used to call Irish twins. In small settlements and camps, people assembled to vote. They elected their most attractive young woman and pooled their resources to groom her and dress her. And equipped with an entourage of stylists and helpmates, each of these beauty queens was sent forth to the courts of men in each lineage. For to have a daughter marry into the lineage ensured a community would not be neglected. As the wife of a lineage prince, she could exert her influence for the benefit of her birthplace. And they journeyed forth, these parties of young ladies, each was a potential queen, accompanied by her handmaidens. And they streamed from court to court, funded by the hope and dreams of their hamlets. Former cheerleaders and homecoming dance royals, harvest queens and rodeo princesses. And as a team, the group showcased their leader, so she might forge a powerful alliance. And in preparation for each meeting, the ladies in waiting curled and peeled. They plucked and combed. Per Talbot, people needed to establish a moratorium on progress. For the next 100 years, there should be a hold on developing new technology and marvels of engineering. For too long, white men had been sublimating their natural impulses through science. So from here on, those energies must be channeled in their natural direction. White men needed to back off from the Industrial Revolution, or the Information Age, or whatever this was. Whites needed to kick back, drink beer, have some outdoor fun, and make nothing but healthy babies. Generation Sex was the motto. The Dukes and Earls, they loved their sports terminology. Team wives suggested wide receivers, tight ends, fullbacks. Field wives brought to mind the packed field of contenders in NASCAR. Every human endeavor, from tire factories to truck farms, was falling under the patronage of some local prince's fiefdom. New money had to be earned and spent quickly. Talbot said the currency would be given a longer life once it was established. But for the present, a skin had to buy bread, gasoline, toothpaste, some grapes, a movie ticket, a pair of socks, passing through that many hands in a single day. Shasta's own parents' marriage had survived because sometimes her mother would leave her wedding ring beside their bathroom sink and go out to have dinner for a few days. Other times, her father went to dinner without his ring. On the website, Chieftain Charlie had caught Shasta's eye, because he was one of the few who didn't lay claim to targeting the actual president of the formerly United States. She'd uploaded a couple good selfies, one a face shot, one a full body. She followed the prompts. Position sought? Lead wife. Would she consider serving as a team wife? Yes. Height? 5'9". Weight? 125 pounds. Any history of hereditary physical or mental illness? None. Hair? Blonde. Eyes? Periwinkle. Race? Caucasian. She hit enter. A prompt appeared. As a condition of acceptance, the applicant must submit to genetic testing to confirm overall health and racial heritage. Shasta had clicked the box labeled Agree. In rooms of any size, sparkling crystal set on silver trays held hooch, excellent hooch, and Jamal poured himself a glass to enjoy while he toured his new domain. He surveyed the tall oil paintings that stretched almost to the ceiling. With their badass swords and medals, these men had been the players of their time. They'd understand him taking this place off the hands of their soft-hearted descendants. These soldier men had taken lives in order to live here, to build these walls and mate with the women who dressed this place and frilled everything. Arabella and her kin were gone home to their place, a smaller house a ways off on the property. This house, the big house, he had to himself. But a house didn't make anyone powerful. Jamal took up his copy of the Talbot book and his glass of good hooch, and he went to the biggest chair in front of the biggest fireplace and settled himself. To read Talbot was to enter into the pattern of his mind. To feel your own thoughts patterned after Talbot's. That was power. To live within the minds of others. To reorganize their minds in accord with your own. To Jamal, that was the greatest power. He couldn't recall the last time he'd sat awake all night in the silent dark, absorbing the words arranged by a writer's mind. But that's how he read tonight. The grand old clocks in the hallways on the mantel ticked like old time bombs. As Talbot put it, whether it's by breeding children or preaching, it's what men do, this constant dissemination of self. To look at white men these days, something vital had been bred out of them. How had those men, the Vikings and the Norse, men who'd sailed their long boats up the Rhine, the Volga, the Dnieper, and Danube to burn and pillage and turn most of the continent blonde and blue-eyed, how had they disappeared so completely? He suspected that for most white men, it was pride enough to not be black or queer. That was reason plenty for separate homelands. It would force men, all men, to earn a reason to feel superior. Not one of these painted men with their mutton-chop sideburns and beards and gold braid had been born great. Each had risked everything for a chance at something better, and to a man, they stood triumphant atop 100 dead enemies or 1,000 dead enemies. Victors and vanquished alike, they were all dead alike and congratulating each other on the valor they had shown. That's when he first heard it. That late night, alone in the house. Jamal didn't want to entertain the idea of spooks haunting him, but that's what his mind seized upon. Considering the targets he'd put down, those people tallied and buried, some terror sent his thoughts down that guilt-ridden path. Except it wasn't any sound usually associated with a ghost. He set his empty glass on a table. His glass on his table in his house, and he wasn't going to be run off by a late-night noise, especially not that particular noise. That thunder of water somewhere and shudder of something through old pipes. It came again and again. Fast, but unmistakable, it was the sound of somebody on a floor far overhead, flushing a toilet. Delicious, sat amid the rank smells and the adjacent wet splashes, locked within the unisex toilet at the restaurant. A knock sounded at the door, followed by a whispered, "Susan?" She leaned forward, whispering, "Gentry?" She unlatched the door and swung it open. Her dress still clung to her curves. She waited, fully clothed, therein. The scrawny white boy who stood in the half-open doorway said, "Don't call me that." His name, before immigrating, His name had been different. He looked both ways in the passage outside the cubicle, then quickly stepped inside, pulling the door closed and locking it. His arms were instantly around her, his mouth on hers. Delicious felt his fingers inching the damp skirt up her thighs. His lips nuzzled the side of her neck. His erection prodded at her through his chinos. Delicious wondered about his burly black dinner partner. She could only hope that bulked-up, hot-blooded brother wasn't tapping her husband's bony white boy's back door. She told herself to chill. She told herself it was harder for a brother being gay. A sister could flirt and be coy, but a dog was expected, especially a gay dog, to be dickin' or getting dicked on a more or less non-stop basis. Still, as Gentry's lips roved over her breasts, she had to ask, "Brian?" His name before was Brian, she asked. "Is that dog been up in you?" His mouth still exploring her, his fingers pawing the dress down her shoulder and exposing her, Gentry mumbled something. He held up his hand and waved it with his fingers spread. A gold ring glittered around one finger. A wedding ring, and not the one she'd given him at their own wedding. "Too loud for a little toilet cubicle," Delicious blasted. "You married him?" Granted, she knew the best way to avoid sex was to get married. Nothing killed the good times faster. But did he have to hook up with the first big he-monster? Or was Geisha like a men's prison, where you needed to be one inmate's bitch or you'd be punked by everyone? Gentry surfaced for air. Panting, he told her. "Neither." "Neither what?" Delicious demanded. "Yeah, he was married to the brother," Gentry explained. "But they weren't doing it." Delicious was confused. Gentry had dropped to his knees and was working his way up inside her dress instead of down. What looked like a pregnancy was Gentry's big white blockhead stretching her skirt at the belly. His hot breath gargled something into her sex. Delicious asked, "What?" She wanted answers, but their time was limited, and she didn't want him to stop. A knock came at the door. Gentry's tongue stopped its running around between her legs. From outside, a voice asked, "Delicious?" It was the redhead, Ginger Prestige. She asked, "You okay?" Whispering close to the door, she asked, "You're not having one of those toilet babies, are you?" Gentry started to laugh. With his mouth cupped over Delicious, he was laughing air into her. He was going to give her pussy farts. She made a fist and rapped on his head with her knuckles to stop. To the nosy redhead, she went nuclear. She hissed, "Don't be racist!" It was the worst accusation you could level in Geisha. It didn't make complete sense in this situation, but it did the trick. The voice said, "My bad." Footsteps seemed to trail away. His head still stretching the hell out of her damp skirt, Gentry said, "Jarvis isn't that way." The muscled-up gym rat making the big show of pushing her skinny husband's legs apart and humiliating him as a downright bitch right here in public, according to Gentry. The brother was heterosexual. He'd immigrated separate from his white wife and had spent the past 7 months trying to find her. For the time being, he and Gentry had gotten married so each other could act as the other's beard. It was a lot to explain with his face shoved into her snatch, but he sounded sincere. The big display of sexually humiliating Gentry was an act. Other times, they'd accuse one another of cruising someone at a nearby table and launch into a screaming slap fight. Gentry was getting to his feet. He was gently but insistently turning her around and lifting the back of her skirt. He took himself out. The public catfights and sexual hazing, This wasn't how actual gays behaved in Geisha. It was strictly the outsider interpretation of two heterosexuals. But it kept people from getting too close. Delicious wanted to ask how they'd met. She wanted to find a nice heterosexual gal and get hitched herself. But now Gentry put himself inside her from behind, so she stepped her feet as wide as the little cubicle allowed. She leaned over the toilet and pushed her ass back against his thrust. The candles were vexing. They wouldn't stay lit. They teetered and toppled and fell. Shasta watched a young woman navigate the sidewalk in the tiny steps a geisha might take. The girl held her head painfully erect, crowned with a wreath of scratchy holly leaves and poisonous mistletoe berries. Six tall white candles jutted up from this crown, each tipped with a flickering flame. Even as Shasta watched, one of the girl's candles tilted. It drizzled melted wax down the bodice of the girl's heavily embroidered dirndl. The off-kilter taper fell. The girl's hand sprang into action, beating at a small fire the flaming wick had ignited in the folds of her linen skirt. The sudden movement scattered the remaining candles from her head. Some rolled in the street. Others dropped into the gutter, where they set fire to used condoms and discarded paper money from the before times. The candles, the crowns of thorns, they were as much a test of poise as they were a Caucasian fashion statement. Shasta figured as much. And wearing this bullshit frippery wasn't so much a quirky trend as it was the law. The dirndl girl cursed quietly as she stripped off the smoking ruins of her skirts and petticoats. Shasta engaged her core muscles and held her spine ramrod straight. Years of yoga had paid off, keeping her own candle steady. Hers was the regal bearing of a monarch in training as she strolled past the unfortunate scene. From elsewhere, a voice called, "Chica!" A male voice. "Nice candles!" Turning to look took a slow eternity. Always the candles to worry about. But Shasta recognized the young man walking toward her. He carried a duffel bag under one arm. In one hand he clutched a paperback book as thick as a brick. He was a brother of her friend Esteban from school. Gay Esteban. She struggled to match a name to his face. "Xavier," he offered. He was the straight brother. "Where do you get off dressing all white girl?" She didn't bother to explain about flunking her DNA test. No duh. But having two grandparents from Quintana Roo had bit her in the ass. She was over-the-line Hispanic, and not one of the good kind like from Spain, either. She asked if he'd seen Walter. Xavier shook his head. He said, "You have a candle out." "Damn," Shasta said as she opened her Kate Spade tote bag. Revealed inside was a squashed jumble of Danish pastries and jelly donuts. She grimaced as she worked her fingers into the mess of puff pastry, Bavarian cream, and powdered sugar. Xavier recoiled from the sight of mashed delicacies, sneering in disgust. "What are you supposed to be?" Lifting her gaze slowly, she looked pointedly at the various other women who carefully sipped lattes or walked dogs on leashes as they balanced a crown of blazing candles atop their heads. "It's Scandinavian."